The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Thursday, August 13th. It's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. And once again, this is C. Anery, and I shall be your host for the day. All kind of things are happening inside the newspaper. You need to go and buy your Guardian newspaper now because the headlines is hot. Seem chaotic. The whole country seemed chaotic at times. And I said, you know, I need to plan a show to direct us on what we should be doing. Right? You know, I've been having a series of the making of the Bahamas, the making of the new Bahamas, and what we should be looking like, what we should be doing, what we should be looking out for, what we should be embracing and taking advantage of. And sometimes I have to get professionals to come in and help me with the conversation. I can't be pontificating by myself all the time and expressing my views and hoping my callers call in and say, well, Neri, we should be doing this. Today, I brought an enterprise risk, corporate, and governance specialist to come in. She's all in big words. I'm not familiar with the big words, right? So I brought her in to first explain what it is that she does. Then I'm going to apply her expertise to in the Bahamas, right? And hopefully it inspires us to do better, inspire us to embrace opportunities, right? To do that SWOT analysis. What is SWOT analysis? Is strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And put that forward, and we look at the Bahamas and say, we're moving forward. I'm tired of marking time. I expect big things for this country. I expect us to be the leaders in the region. I don't necessarily think that we are the leaders inside the region, but I demand that we be the leaders in the region. I expect that the country in that global north country right there should respect us in terms of how they see us as a country. They say, hey, that's the Bahamas, but they have some smart people there. So we can't bully them. We can't dictate to them. We have to take into account that these people are competent and that they could lead themselves, that they, in fact, are our partners and they will be respected as our partners. So that's why I had to bring this risk management specialist in the studio. I'm hoping that she could be like my guest co-host every so often, that she comes in, analyze news, that we analyze what is happening regionally in this hemisphere, and particularly analyze what is happening in the Bahamas. And this show is about the Bahamas, right? And so we can have a better country. I just want a better country, man. And I speaking to her back and forth, I say, man, she have all kind of ideas. She have all kind of ideas because of her specialty, her skill set, what she does. And I say, oh, let me bring it to the fore, that to let my listening audience know that there are people in the Bahamas that do this as for a career, right, who is recognized regionally and globally for their skills, their skill set, and nationally they should be embraced and are embraced. And so let me, all that, without further ado, let me introduce you. Without further ado, let me introduce you to Siobhan Johnson. Welcome to Guardian Radio here.
Good morning, Bahamas. Good morning, CA.
Good. So first of all, a number of my listening audience are not familiar with the term enterprise risk corporate governance specialist, whatever it is. So you might have to give us a general breakdown. What is it that you do? So we can appreciate it to the general conversation that we plan to have shortly.
So enterprise risk is literally about anything and any threat, basically, that could stop an organization or an institution could be broad, from accomplishing its objective. So in the corporate world, that could be you have compliance risk, you have financial risk, you have operational risk. So it's a bit of everything. The best risk management strategies anticipates risk first, tries to measure an appetite so that you prevent bad things from happening, or you respond as effectively as possible when they do, to contain and curtail that risk exposure.
Risk and exposure. So I know, let me see if I can preempt this.
Wait, and then corporate governance, when you have a body, they're supposed to have an authoritative that sets strategy that says this is what we want to accomplish, then make sure that all the resources, the policies, the procedures, the risk appetite, everything is in alignment to what it is that that entity is trying to accomplish, and it's managed to that. So your boards, typically when people think of corporate governance, they think of boards, but it's more than that. You know, it's about the brain, the heart, and how everything is going to be controlled and promotes accountability, ethics, fairness, transparency. That's your corporate governance. It's your culture. It's all those things. It's very broad. Will strengthen, and good corporate governance and good enterprise risk management will basically strengthen any institution, including the family and the church.
So you do consultant work, and I know you have a number of clients, so I'll try and make all of this conversation broad, right? So we don't get any kind of issues.
Yes, please.
But in terms of governance, in terms of good governance, what should a country be doing?
So first of all, you know, we are countries, all civilized countries are have laws, right? So we should establish sound laws to govern the country. And then we would obviously have, you know, the different branches of, you have government. But outside of government, we're a democracy. So we're going to have, you know, the private sector. You have journalists that are the fourth estate. So you have non-for-profits. So we should have a culture, right? And our culture should mean something, and we should have values. So to me, when all those pieces come together with leadership that has values, then that's pretty much to me what the country needs. In our party system, which is primarily two-party system, it's good to have a leading party and opposition, right? Because they're opposite to account. And that balance is typically good. But I think for the most part, you see in the last two decades or so, where popularism has overtaken many places in the world. And whenever that governance structure gets out of whack from what the people really care to see, it brings it back in balance. So you never should take out individual contribution and individual responsibility to ensure that the government is always doing what is right for the country.
You mentioned culture and values, and continuous government tend to take on projects, but the projects never seem to be completed for whatever reason. I'm not saying one government is better than the next one, just in our governance, we have big, grandiose ideas that we're going to do this. And at the end of 10 years, at the end of 20 years, what we ever planned for did not manifest. And you mentioned culture and values. What is happening? Why that's happening?
I don't think it's a secret. I think there was some scandal. I think it was the police. There was some corruption on the force. And someone, which one, said, well, they come from amongst us, right? And some persons took exception to that. But basically, what we see assimilate to the top came from the bottom. It's us. So if our values are skewed, then the leaders that we have, their values can be seen to be skewed, right? So we see it. We all have a collective responsibility to hold ourselves to account in everything that we do. We've now have a culture of turning a blind eye, you know, until it makes, now with, you know, social media, things are shared more broadly. But a lot of the bad things that we see, it was happening all along. Very few of it is new, right? So it's there, it's right in front of us, but we turn blind eyes. We know the injustices that are happening. We don't speak up. We don't protest much. You know, as a country. And this isn't about politics, because a lot of people, they get over-sensationalized about politics. Like every institution, the family, the church, the school, every institution has issues and we're turning blind eyes. You know, I grew up in, went to Aquinas, right? So by tradition, I grew up in Salem Baptist Church. But when I was a part of Aquinas, you know, that whole scandal with the priests blew up, right? And then when you look at the history, there was this culture, especially in the Caribbean too, of persons being moved from one place and sent to another, never dealing with it. So our culture did that, you know, so we can't pass it on to someone else. We watched and we knew of family members that were harmed and the person was just moved. And that was it. They were someone else's problem.
Prime Minister suggested that the Bahamas has a culture of corruption. There's a culture of corruption in this corruptible situations. Just recently, we had a prison officer who was made corruptible, or it's a situation made him corruptible. He, according to the newspaper, was smuggling things into the prison. As a risk management person, what can we do to stop things like that? Because it seems like it's our culture, like it can happen no matter what. But clearly, we can do things to stop that.
Well, I think that we have to remember some fundamentals, supply and demand. So there was clearly a demand for what he was supplying.
We need phones in the prison. Right? The prisoners want their phones.
And then, clearly, like I was saying, someone was turning a blind eye. I mean, I'm sure most people have probably visited or have heard of how the structure of the prison is. I went there when I was at Aquinas. We walked through. And there's all these different levels of, you know, security as you go from one area to the next with persons who are watching. So how do you have smuggling happening in the prison and nobody knows? Then if it's contraband items, like someone is behaving, like after someone actually ingests some form of, you know, drugs or whatever, there's behavioral changes. So are we really managing what we have, you know, closely? So to me, we just have a culture where there are certain things that are permissible until someone gets in trouble and then we correct the behavior. That's kind of like, we're not preventative. You know, when you look so extreme, but like some of the Asian cultures in Singapore, you know, their fines for just like spitting on the ground are, you know, you get punished. They try to drive and promote the behavior by consequence. What is the real consequence? You know,
can that work in the Bahamas, consequence? Because I don't want to get a strap against my back for spitting out a gum. I don't care if that enforces Bahamians to live better. To get strap across your back because you spit out gum, because you spit on the sidewalk, I don't know if Bahamians can bear that.
Well, it starts before you're an adult. Like in a lot of those cultures, even when you go in some of the school systems, the kids are part of cleaning up every day. You know, they have to do dishes. They have to do the yard work. So they learn from early to take care of going back to our values. Do we really value the state of the environment when we're keeping a dirty environment around us? So as children, if we sensitize them that your environment must always be clean, then when they get to be an adult and they see someone else doing it, they will be disgusted and they want them to be held to account. But we have to basically decide as a country one, our country to be. Just complain. We go to the beach and someone has their food and they just throw it on the ground, they leave it and they go and it's accepted. Sometimes you even look in certain cultures, there's signage that reinforces good behavior because you can't assume that that person came from an environment that reinforced that good behavior, right? And so they have enough trash receptacles along the road and they have signage that says you cannot, because it may seem simple, but a reinforcement, you cannot dump here. Put it in the garbage. See the garbage located there with an arrow. And so we leave it for the person to make the decision, but they themselves are either not mature to think that way or it's not their value system. So we're here expecting them to be civilized, but that's just not them.
So you're saying in order to reinforce values, there needs to be someone responsible for putting up signage and explaining the information to reinforce this value for those persons who might haphazardly forget or just didn't consider it?
Well, in my world, it's called behavioral, right? So like if you want someone to practice good behavior and they don't innately know it, you put them in place that reinforces it because it's not innately going to come from them. So yes, you need resources that are fining, that's basically enforcing consequence and good behavior.
Watch me get you in trouble.
Oh, jeez.
What if I am an employee and I have a job to be done? And I could say, well, this job is going to take me 5 hours to do. But I say, man, I don't want to do this in one setting. I can need some overtime. I can need some overtime. And the overtime cost would be like 600,000. No, sorry, don't that number come out of nowhere. That's a random number. Watch I'm just you. Making it up. I'm just making that number. I'm just saying it's not coincidental.
See, ain't
right? Who's responsible for making sure I don't abuse my overtime?
Okay, so I'm an accountant. That's what I studied, right? That's my profession. So there's something very basic around this, right? Controls. And so you have controls around someone that normally, in most organizations, before you can perform overtime, it has to be authorized by someone.
You said overtime must be authorized by somebody?
Yeah, so there's a need for you to work outside of regular hours. So someone should make sure that they approve that there is a need. So that's the first time to preventing potential abuse. Then after that happens, there should be checking out that the work or the services that was to be performed was performed that was needed at an acceptable level. Because we're assuming if it's overtime, it's outside of normal hours or outside of normal duties.
So there's someone who's supposed to be checking this, you said?
Absolutely. It's supervision. So in most, and especially in a unionized environment, you're going to have supervision. Right? You're going to have supervision. So if the supervision is missing, the lack of authorization. So if me as an employee, I'm just using it as like a cash cow and there's no one that to regulate me, of course, I'm going to do what is best in the best interest of my pocket. Right? And I'm not saying, like you said, you're not going to get me in trouble. No. I'm not making any specific reference to anything, but I'm just saying in general, there are standard practices that overtime is approved, overtime is somehow supervised and verified that the work expected to be done was completed. And then when it's time for payment, there's segregation. The person who is reviewing and authorizing the payment and sending the money to the bank is different from the person associated with who did the work or authorized the work. So when that money goes to the bank, right? And then over time, there's another concept of like health and safety. It is not safe for someone to work excessively outside continuous basis. There's normally some depletion of performance because if the normal workday is 8 to 10 hours, right? Let's say, and you're working 16 to 18 hour days for 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's probably a little impossible to happen, but it's definitely unhealthy. So now outside of financial controls, you also have a health and safety control and the wellness of that employee, that in one employee or a few employees are allowed to work excessively and that there was no diminishing return. So that overtime you thought you were getting productivity, are you really? Because the person
returns.
Is tired, mm-hmm. right? And then when the numbers get big, on a management level, overtime is an expense, right? So it's a cost of doing business. And so that line item, if there are spikes and someone completely independent of that team should just be like a CFO or finance manager, someone should be analyzing that from the time it spiked on at least monthly, saying, hey, what's going on with this spike, mm-hmm. right? Because the resources are supposed to be prudently managed, right? So I don't know executive management who normally collectively have a responsibility that the organization is being well managed. And so when you're having these unusual spikes in expenses, you're supposed to justify and monitor what's going on before it gets out of hand.
That makes sense to me. I mean, to work, I'm responsible for managing time, right? And I watching people talk and they saying something wrong here. Something
talking all day and they ain't working. Yeah.
Let's go to these callers. I have a number of callers on the board. So this is time to call. We're talking to our risk management corporate governance specialist, Ms. Siobhan Johnson. I just shooting the breeze with her. I'm hoping that she'll join me with my Make It of the Bahamas program, where we analyze the Bahamas and what we should be doing and how we could improve productivity into the Bahamas. But go ahead, caller. Guiding Radio AM, you're live. Call you there. Clear that line and let's go to the next one, Kermit. Go ahead, caller. Guiding Radio AM, you live?
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Great. Just had to turn my radio down. I like what the lady is saying. She's coming to us very well. I didn't hear you at the onset, but I think I got enough to realize that you're speaking in general, if that's so, in terms of employment, employees, employers,
mm-hmm.
Overtime.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I am wondering, why is it? I know nurses get overtime for the hours they put in, and rightfully so. No, on that, hands down, they should. But why is it that educators don't? Like, you can take papers home, you're working overtime, because you can't do it during the classroom time where you're teaching and you're giving instructions, you're monitoring students. So you're always end up with a whole lot of paperwork and planning and all that type of thing. So why is it there no consideration in the government system or any system for educators to obtain overtime? I'll hang up and listen to you.
You want to talk like that, or want me to respond to that?
Anyone. Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Thanks very much, Cola.
So many of our professions, where they're unionized, the unions are the bargaining unit for the employees. So for the teachers, their bargaining unit, I think it's led by Belinda Wilson, it's their role to negotiate the compensation structure on behalf of the teachers. Every profession has job duties and, you know, normally a job description. And so the job descriptions that say, we call it FTE, full-time equivalency of how much hours it actual job. And so as an educator, if your classroom time is, say, 9 to 3, but your grading time is outside of that, all of that should be taken into consideration. I don't know that it's ideal to say overtime, because I think that my sister is a teacher. I've tutored, I've taught. So you have your instructional time with whoever the student is, but then you have the time to grade, you have to plan, there's a lot. So that really should be negotiated, I would think, in the salary. Overtime is meant for over and above. So to me, a lot of what you described is really a part of being an educator. So what it is you want to, and it's one of those professions, in my opinion, and we all felt it during COVID, we did not want to be with our kids at home. We value educators in the country. And so I think we're moving towards, in general, better compensation for essential services and important careers. But I think it's a part of negotiating, right? And we as a country, not just the bargaining, we have to say how we value teachers. But on the flip side, the teachers and the union that represent them have to negotiate what is a fair wage for all of the duties that goes into being an educator. Now, if you're running like after school programs or these other things, to me, those are ancillary, those are additional. I'm not sure what your, at what point you think that the work that you do at home is overtime. You know, that's probably not, in my opinion, the best example, because being an educator includes grading papers that I don't know that you finish in the classroom. Now, when it comes to workload, like if there's a teacher shortage and you're taking on additional responsibility, more than one FTE or more than one teacher, that's a different conversation. That means your need to work extra time at home is because you're actually doing the duty one person. And again, the bargaining should take place in the union agreement as to how that should be handled. That shouldn't be a one-off.
Okay, we have another caller here. We want to address you. And again, I try and get some pertinent questions out, right, without influencing into your thing. But let me continue. Go ahead, caller. Guardian Radio AM, you're live. Caller, you there? Caller, going once. Caller, going twice. And this is the question I was going to ask you next. You, in your professional life, have worked in a unionized environment. I reading the newspaper, The Guardian, I came across a piece of an article, and I said, man, this don't make no sense to me. And I'm going to read it. I'm going to watch to see your reaction to what is being said, right? And like I said, you don't necessarily have to respond to it. I'm going to my page now, CA Nuri page right now. I'm going to read it to you, right? This said The Guardian newspaper. A BPL spokesperson told the Nassau Guardian that Alston had no comment on the matter. And forgive me, right? Like I said, you don't have to answer this. I'm just going to read it in terms of unionized environment. Okay. The policy dated August 31st, 2025, establishes clear guidelines for overtime work at BPL. But Wilson said this year-old policy by the board, which was only made known to the union on Monday. So that's where I'm getting the issue. But Wilson said this year-old policy by the board, which was only made known to the union on Monday, breaches the industrial agreement of the BEWU. It's just a total fallacy, said Wilson,
who represents over 1,000 BPL employees. I mean, we have an overtime clause in our contract, and so to see the contractual agreement that registered is just ludicrous. It's trying to figure out who is on our board and who is advising the board into such idiosyncrasies of some sort. Idiocies. Okay, this is my question to you. In a unionized place, who informed the board, who informs the union that we're changing the policy?
So what I will safely say is that there's something called internal controls, right? And so internal controls should take into account any authoritative agreements, be it a law or union agreement in an organization. So if the board is responsible for policy, for setting policy, approving policies in the organization. So if there's some issue, some risk, some threat, some mismanagement, anything, it is the board's right and rule in their fiduciary duties to address those things with updated policies and procedures. I stand corrected, but I think that most union agreements have more of a right to inform, a right to engage and communicate. It isn't like the board has to accept what the union says, per se. Now, if an established union policy exists, then the board or the union to have that changed. And you'll know that in the last administration, we had a lot of union agreements that had been outstanding in terms of being finalized for a very long time that hadn't been finalized. So sometimes what's happening too is you had these antiquated agreements and language that no longer met, you know, the requirements of the environment. So that right to inform may vary from agreement to agreement. So I don't want to speak specifically, but typically it's a cross between normally, depending on how contentious it is, it's depending on what the organization's mandates are and how they want to execute them. But it's normally someone senior, it's normally HR, it's normally legal, it's normally a committee. Normally it's a whole conversation because these things are best witness, right? You don't ever want to enter in a negotiation or you're changing something or something could result into strikes or noise and there weren't witnesses to what really happened. There weren't notes taken about what really happened. But when you remove the emotion, at the end of the day, I don't think there's any union agreement date what an organization's needs are, how they evolve, okay? Is that because they represent the employees who are a large part of the organization, there must be, and you would hear this in the speaking, respect, right? Respectful engagement on both sides, from the union to the leadership of the organization and the board and the other way around. And sometimes when that respect breaks down, a lot of what you just read is too vague for me to comment more specifically on. But basically, some of what it said, and sometimes when we listen to the union, it's almost as if the management teams don't have a right to make a change. They can change. They just have to consult with the union. And through that consultation, either there's agreement or there's non-agreement. And if the union don't like the decision taken, then they act, which is well within their right. And within our laws, it says, you know, if you're going to strike, what you're supposed to do to be able to strike, et cetera. But basically, management does have an obligation normally to consult with the union.
Okay. We have another caller who wants to engage you. Let's see if they're there. Go ahead, caller. Guiding Radio AM.
Mr. Nuri, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How you doing?
Mr. Nuri, this overtime thing. Let me tell you something. There's about that this lady might know or might know. From back in the 70s, when I used to work with the Water Corporation building the Arawaki project, there are some supervisors that they're very smart. We go to job to be employed. You know, there are some supervisors I know because I've been exposed to it. Would allow employees to work overtime, encourage overtime, and they split the overtime money at the end of it. When man tell you, hey, man, I can get you to work some overtime, and no, you ain't got nothing to do. The water barge ain't coming in until tomorrow morning, but you could stay on the duty. You get over there, and at the end of the day, when you get paid, we split the money.
Okay. Let's go to the next caller there. Guy in Radio AM, you live.
And you're ready to it.
Patience. Patient like Job.
Yeah. You know, I have a question. ask your guests how many non-contributory pension, non-contributory pension funds are there, you know, among the government agencies, please.
I'll see if she knows anything about that. That's all I could do. Okay, thanks. You know anything about that?
I know that a lot of the pension liabilities that do exist are underfunded. I can't remember because I know that there was a conscious effort to move towards contributory because it's not sustainable. If you listen to like some of the NIB reports that have been gone, there's like basically we're not having enough children. We weren't having enough children to replace the aging population who were contributing to NIB, for instance, for that. But I can't say the exact number. But basically, historically, government funds. But I believe a policy was made that for new employees, certainly when I was affiliated, new employees, I think they were moving towards being contributory. So I know there was a shift and a policy decision to move away from non-contributory. So I don't have the numbers. So I'm not sure what his second half of his question was. I don't have the numbers, but I know that a policy decision was made to move away for that because it was not sustainable.
Let's move back to the Bahamian psyche and us in general and what we need to do to help our government, to help our social arms and doing being more progressive, being more productive. I think it's the right word. What should we be doing as citizens of the Bahamas now?
And I definitely have to issue a disclaimer with this one. But I feel that because someone becomes the government, you said the government, right?
Yeah.
Because someone becomes a senior representative, I assume you mean politicians, if I could be more specific. Because a politician has ascended in such a high role in the country does not mean, if we be honest, that all of them are best qualified to be that or to sit in those places. So we have to support them because at the end of the day, we voted them in. We decided, and their failure is our failure. We want them to succeed. So we have to channel our energy. I choose to channel my energy more positive to work through non-for-profits because the reality is, and again, having been affiliated with government twice, I know that there's bureaucracy that stops productivity. And so sometimes it's better to work outside of government and just get mandatory approvals where you need them. So I think that we must be creative. There's a lot of free money in the world. I think we should spend more time so that people who really mean well don't get frustrated with grants, global grants. And a lot of times, a lot of countries or organizations don't access that money because they don't do what they're supposed to do with the money. If you applied for a grant and they gave you a grant for $20 million and this is what you were supposed to do and they gave you the covenants, honor them because that could be additional money. Then we have to have very strong project management skills for want of a better reference because you need someone to keep us on track, right? There are people, unfortunately, at the table, they don't have good work ethics. You know, they'll take the money, say they're going to do what they're supposed to do and they don't do it. So you have to have checks and balances in place. We need to strengthen, and I think moves are being made so that when people don't do what they're supposed to do, it's not so hard to get your money back from them or to be more punitive because we're never going to correct the behavior. I think we need to, in non-confrontational ways, I know because of social media, like some of the personalities, there's a lot of personalities and noise on social media, but we really should be more activist, you know.
And let me pause you there because you say more activists, right, yeah. Or advocates in general. There's a number of Bahamians who are frustrated for whatever reason. They are discontent with their governance, be it or whoever is in charge, right? What can they do, or what should they be doing? How do they get their concerns heard by the government?
So I'm still a huge believer of the power of influence.
Okay.
I feel that it works for a lot of people, but it just works for circles, right? But it also works. You'll see some town halls, when town halls are held, a lot of people don't show up.
So who's supposed to host a town hall means?
But they are hosted. So when, for instance, when there's development going on, physical planning routinely, it's mandatory, hold town hall meetings. And a lot of times people don't show up.
Mm.
You know, so if you're not participating, like casting a ballot every 5 years isn't the only time we should be participating.
Mm-hmm.
If you see things happening at a school where they're educating our kids, you know, right now, this is not a knock on anyone, but I see a lot of back to school events about, you know.
I talked about it yesterday.
Oh,
go ahead.
Sorry, I missed
it. No,
the
no,
show.
Go ahead.
Giving away the backpacks and all that. But I think we have a real issue going back into the school system. You know, I pray for my educators. I'm a member of the Bahamas Literacy Association. I pray for them who are really trying to correct that D average. And they have to spend so much time with behavioral issues in the classroom. Where are the events leading up to back to school to start to address? You saw the young boy being bullied, telling his friend, mm-hmm. you're my friend. I don't want to fight you. You see all these girls fighting. Where's the activities dealing with that? Because that's going to re-enter the schools. So, yes, we need the things. But, I mean, how many backpacks does someone need? They need behavioral. They need a focus on the importance of education. Like, we have a problem that we're breeding that enough attention isn't given to. You know, we have to say kudos to, like, Lend a Hand Bahamas, Urban Renewal, churches, the Chankanu groups that have after-school activities. We need that, but like we literally have to reset minds. And back to your question, we have to be more active. Like my parents were young and had five kids in a house, and they were young and they were active in their personal life. But we had a whole village that took care of us, and we have to bring that village back. I mean, I saw a group of girls walking down the street and nobody's saying anything. We have to reel them in. We just have to get more active as citizens.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. I'm joined with Ms. Siobhan Johnson, who is Enterprise Risk Corporate Governance Specialist. She's given her expertise, some advice. We're talking about generally about the Bahamas and some things that is headlined inside the newspaper today also, which she's just briefly given commentary about. But I want to know what we should be doing. How do we improve this Bahamas? She mentioned back to school. She mentioned some things that we should be doing for in the classroom before the classroom actually opens up. And I want to have a discussion about that also. And we'll be right back in a brief moment.
Attention, Island Game players. Percy's Pension Plan is now accepting applications. Deposit $25 and you are officially in the running for a weekly salary of up to $1,000 a week for a full year. Applicant September 8th. Apply now at theislandgame.com.
As the summer days wind down, a new school year begins. Grab your checklist and head on over to Kelly's House and Home for their 20% off back to school sale, except on net items now through September 2nd. They have everything you need like Toto, JanSport, and character backpacks, lunch boxes, composition books, pens, pencils, calculators, and more. Spend $50 or more on school supplies and you could win a laptop computer or a Crayola-filled stocking. Catch Kelly's House and Home's back to school sale now through Tuesday, September 2nd.
Running low on summer funds? Squeeze every drop of fun out of your summer with Fidelity Personal Loan. From backyard upgrades to family getaways, Fidelity is here to help. Call 356-7764 today.
Fidelity, we're good for you.
We're gonna give you a check every week for a year.
Percy's Pension Plan, Island Game, keep you winning. Percy's Pension Plan, dream big, we will help you live it. Percy's Pension Plan, Island Game, we got you. Percy's Pension Plan, from the friends you can trust. Winning is a must. Go play the game, you know, cause your best chance is with us. The most trustworthy name is Percy's Island Game. So put 20 on your account and ride this easy train at Percy's Island Game.
And welcome back to Guardian Radio AM. Of course, this segment is sponsored by Percy's Island Game, right? So, yeah, players, Percy's Pension Plan is now accepting applications. Deposit $25. And you are officially in the running for a weekly salary up to $1,000 per week for a full year. You hear that? For a full year. So your application closed on September 8th, which is close, right? And apply now at theislandgame.com. I'd like to remind people, this is a promotional gaming campaign and is not an insurance policy. It's not a pension plan. It's not a retirement savings plan or investing product or other regulated financial service. I'm here speaking to Ms. Siobhan Johnson, and I want to ask some political questions. And not because you are some expert on it, because I know who you are. I know what you're involved in. And I said, since I got you here, I just asked what I was. Might as well ask, right?
Might as well.
In both parties, major parties, there's tension. A lot of people feel like they ain't happy. Like they're getting overlooked, right? You see the griping, and the griping is getting ugly. I, on my show, talk about what I call political sycophants who are monstrous. And when they're monstrous, they attack people left, right, and center, right? You tend to be a person who tend to speak positive all the time. And I said, well, this is a peculiar woman, right? how can political parties promote working together for the benefit of their political party instead of having these separate groups within the party as known political assassins?
Disclaimer, but I don't think it's unique. You know, we pretty much have two political parties, leading political parties, the FNM and the PLP. And each one has its history. Each one has its structure. They have a power base. And then I think that when you look outside of our country, politics just attracts certain things. It attracts personalities. It attracts different interests, people who are motivated by different things. So you can't really manage that out. The structure of control and authority is what balances it out. Like you will attract, power attracts, right? Money attracts, opportunity attracts. So you cannot stop personalities from coming to a political end. In fact, it thrives on them, right? It's how you control it when it gets out of whack. You know, in some parties, you have people who are like from a particular political family, perceived to be these are the, you know, the childs, right? They're the privileged family. You know, you have privilege in political parties for different reasons, right? It could be your lineage. It could be who you're connected to. It could be the value that you bring. It could be your influence. It's all kinds of things. You could be a major donor. You can't stop certain things. It's, at the end of the day, each party has a leader. And each organization has a leader. And the leaders set the tone. And then there's, we can't hide it. There's, even outside our country, when you look at the Republicans and the Democrats, like the role of lobbyists and money in politics, like regardless, they have influence. So I think a lot of times people talk about politics from a very naive and an emotional way. Like there's power circles within political parties and they're driven by different things. And so I don't think it's anything that you could manage out. It's at the end of the day, what do you want the face of the party to look like? Who do you want to be their spokesperson? And I'm sure that from my own personal experience, when things sometimes go awry, there are people who are watching. There are people who call people in, you know, and correct behaviors. And there are just people who are, anything that you see is allowed to happen, in my opinion, it's allowed to happen.
So what do you do for, and like I said, as you do your SWOT analysis to make sure that entities continue? When you have disgruntled people in amongst your ranks, what should be concentrated upon?
So I'll go back to my risk management side. So we have this thing where communication risk, right? So you used to call it the 5 p.m. news test, right? And it says when something happens and it hits the news, will it be talked about for just a few minutes and then you're on to the news story, to the next story? Is it going to be talked about for 24 hours and you're on to the next story? Or is it something that, the worst case scenario, it caused some sort of permanent reputational damage or other financial damage? something that it costs you something you care about, right? And so at the end of the day, you're still engaged in risk management. You still have some sort of appetite for conduct. You have an appetite for fallout. You have an appetite, and at the end of the day, it's a gamble. You know, you take a gamble, you take a risk, and the chips has to fall where they may with whatever decision you make.
Okay, we have another telephone call wants to engage. So let's get to the telephone call there, Kermit. Guardian Radio AM, you're live.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Nuri.
Good morning.
Good morning to your guests.
Good morning.
Yeah, Mr. Nuri, I wanted you to bring an update on the guy who had the problem with the septic prostate joint during the extraction, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
That was quite frightening, and I thank you for bringing consciousness to a scenario like that. Really and truly, all right?
Yeah,
now, for the lady, I like everything she's saying, of course, positive, negative reinforcement. But the thing is, for me, what comes into my mind is the rights of the individual versus the rights of the collective, and then turn around, like to say, well, I mean, no man is an island. And so I honestly believe in what she's saying, power to the people. But for me, I think she said that it starts from the bottom as relates to recruitment. And she said a public figure gave a statement as relates to corruption and saying it comes from among us, right? But I didn't really like that particular narrative, because corruption or impeding corruption requires the public, and she said activism, et cetera, and I totally agree with that. But when someone, a citizen is not, a private citizen who's a civilian, I mean, they haven't sworn to uphold their duties, et cetera, like a Royal Bombers Defense Force, Police Force, et cetera, certain, you know what I mean, people. They didn't swear to uphold this, but there's nothing being done to curtail corruption as relates to them. They're not going to implement laws to curtail themselves, meaning to impede corruption. And so the onus is on them to enforce it and to live it. And so I find it, it's their duty to, because they are in a position to display it and provide the public with comfort. If we see where there's a preponderance or an abundance of corruption, then the people can't trust them, and so that leads to a failure of society. When we are hearing narratives like inclusivity and egalitarianism, and all of these are just farces, whether it comes from the Nimble Gold developments. I saw it in the COVID-19 in the Great Reset. I just hang up and listen, because, I mean, it's the government's duty. So, I mean, activism is the way, but when slavery, the slaves didn't sit around and say, oh, master, free me, oh, master, free me. Have a good day.
Let me use his point for something that's happening today. There's an issue with the taxi union right now. I don't want you to comment on that per se, but I wanted to comment on the duty of care does the taxi union have for the nation versus the duty of care the government have to the taxi union and, again, the nation. The taxi union said they ain't happy. They said they had an agreement, right? And they said they prepared to do industrial action. That industrial action, they're preparing to impact the whole country, can impact me and impact you. And I'm trying to say, I understand they have for some frustration, but as your expertise is, how too far? I mind you during some advocacy and activist work, but when you say you can shut down the airport and think, I can't be your friend no more.
So I think that we let, going back to risk management, sometimes we let things go too far. You know, you have wrong on both sides. So I'll speak with my thoughts on it, because I have thought there's wrong on both sides, right? There's abuse on both sides. The rules say that a livery person should not directly solicit. Like, they're supposed to, unless someone asks for the service. Just if we travel all over the world, you could go to the yellow cab, or you could go to the, you know, the black cars, right? So if you break the rule, then they have just right to complain. But I think the larger issue, and I think I listened to the gentleman that heads the Union for the Livery Plates talk about, you know, rolling out a rideshare app. You know, had the taxi cab union basically modernized, I think that they, because right now, my 18-year-old daughter has been trying to take the equivalent of rideshares, and I'm like, girl, listen to me. I will pick you up at any time. Do not use those vehicles. But if I knew that it was regulated, I would totally pay for it. And so you have an underserved domestic market when it comes to transportation at night. There are lots of people who want to go out and drink, and they don't want to be worried about driving. So I think so much time is being spent fighting each other over a few slots at the airport versus if the objective is to make money and feed your family, which is what they get out there to be made, not just from tourists, right? You have people that want your service. So I think they need to focus on modernizing that industry. And I think that there's wrong on both sides because it's our culture. Sometimes we just want to cheat, right? So there are probably, I'm not making a direct accusation, but there are probably taxi drivers doing things they shouldn't be doing. And there's probably livery drivers that are doing what they shouldn't be doing.
There are times when behemoths will critique the government that their primary concern is not necessarily for the benefit of behemoths. They saying that even how we do talk about the ride share there, that if they put behemoths first in their objective and their mandate to manage the Bahamas, it'll be a better society. It just seems that all of our concerns is foreign based, and then we hope that the residuals benefit behemoths.
I think that a lot of behemoths don't know how our country really, really works and where decisions are made. You know, and if you go in OPM, the BIA, the Bahamas Investment Authority, and the NEC, when it comes to foreign direct investment, you know, a lot of that comes through that office, right? And it's formally approved and all of that. But we wash our hands off of it. We see it getting more than what they return back to us, right? And we just, we're passive, right? And so if that's where the decision has been made, making noise isn't going to solve the problem. Why aren't you going to where the decision is made and applying pressure to better decisions being made and it being managed better? That really, we are a wealthy nation and we really have given away a lot of our wealth and we're not managing the return. If we managed the return, we wouldn't need to be fighting so much.
That's what I'm going to start up with when you come back again. That same point right there. It's now 12 o'clock. This has been Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Nuri. Of course, I had Siobhan Johnson.
Thank you for having me.
It's fun to have you on like at least once a week, if the time allows, right? She's an enterprise risk corporate governance specialist, right? She deals with risk management and how to improve organizations in general. And I'm glad that she was here just to give us a brief rundown on how we can improve the Bahamas in general. This has been Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Nuri. You have a wonderful day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, streaming on guardiantalkradio.com and the Guardian Radio.